Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 15, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on a misstep in environmental regulation sponsored by the Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group. This is a special courthouse steps edition of our teleform conference call based on a D.C. Circuit case. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome our experts who actually argued the case before the D.C. Circuit. Theodore Hadzi-Antich, who is a senior staff attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. More complete bio was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation and followed by your questions. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. I'm going to be talking about two cases, the oral arguments for which were held last Friday in the D.C. Circuit. The panel was comprised of judges Tatel, Ginsburg, and Edwards. The first case is Delta Construction Company v. EPA, and that case involves a challenge of our clients to federal greenhouse gas emissions for new trucks. And the second case is California Construction Trucking Association v. EPA, and there our clients challenged greenhouse gas emissions for new cars or light-duty vehicles. The same panel was heard both of the cases, and they were heard one after the other on last Friday morning. The issue in both cases should have been a straightforward one of statutory interpretation. And really the cases were about whether the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, can ignore with impunity a non-discretionary statutory mandate to submit its proposed rules to the Science Advisory Board, the SAB, for peer review. So both of these proposed rules, the one for new trucks and the one for new cars, were not submitted to peer review to the Science Advisory Board. And we think that's an important issue because if EPA is basically allowed to thwart a non-discretionary rulemaking duty mandated by statute, in effect, it places itself above the law. Just a little bit of background with regard to the Science Advisory Board statute. It was enacted in the late 1970s, and the purpose of it was to deal with the heavy criticism that EPA regulations were subjected to because of the lack of credibility of the underlying data that purportedly supported regulatory proposals, and also EPA's in-house scientific analysis that purportedly supported those proposals. So in order to deal with that criticism, Congress enacted the SAB submittal requirement. It was part of a IRTA amendment. And what that required was that EPA submit each and every regulatory proposal, and we'll define what that means in a couple of minutes. But the basic requirement is EPA had to submit every regulatory proposal under any statute that it administers to the Science Advisory Board for peer review, and before they could promulgate the regulatory proposal in final form. And it's interesting to note that throughout the decades since the enactment of the SAB submittal requirement, EPA has been pretty good at consistently complying with the SAB submittal requirement. And that was all until December of 2009. And in December of 2009, EPA proposed what's known as the endangerment finding under the Clean Air Act. And that's its finding that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases pose a substantial threat to human health and welfare. And it made that finding after the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts v. EPA, which found that carbon dioxide was indeed a pollutant. Now, bear in mind, you know, what carbon dioxide is, which is the most prevalent greenhouse gas. It's a, you know, ubiquitous natural substance that's essential to life on Earth. It's literally everywhere, and it's in everything. And so by making the finding of endangerment for this substance that's everywhere and in everything, EPA gave itself a springboard to regulate pretty much every place and everything in it. And so the endangerment finding was a big, big deal. Why didn't EPA submit the endangerment finding to the Science Advisory Board for peer review? Well, we don't know to this day. But the fact that this was one of the first major rules that was not submitted to SAB prior to promulgation has got to lead one to scratch his or her head about why that's the case. What makes these carbon dioxide findings and rules any different? Well, to make a long story short, the endangerment finding was challenged by hundreds of industry petitioners and state petitioners. And unfortunately, the D.C. Circuit required all the industry petitioners to file one joint opening brief and one reply brief, and then all of the state petitioners had to file one opening and one reply brief. With regard to the industry petitioners, of which we were a part, there were 89 different lawyers fighting for turf in the opening brief and in the reply brief. So you can imagine the conference calls of lawyers all over the country representing their clients wanting as much turf in the briefs as they could possibly get, and the long negotiations involved in that. And of course, the upshot was that nobody got all of the room that they needed in the brief because of the page limitations. On our Science Advisory Board issue, we received a total of 3 pages in the opening brief and 1.5 pages in the reply brief. And so small wonder that when the D.C. Circuit issued its opinion in the endangerment finding, it gave 2 paragraphs to the Science Advisory Board issue. Just a very summary, conclusory statement with virtually no analysis, holding that the SAB requirement did not apply to the endangerment finding. And in other parts of their opinion, they completely rejected all of the challenges by the industry petitioners and the state petitioners. We filed a petition for certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court on the SAB issue, which was not taken up by the court. Others also filed petitions, some of which were taken up, but those petitions which were taken up are beyond the scope of our discussion today, so I won't address those. But suffice it to say that when cert was denied on the SAB issue for our case and the endangerment finding, that revived 2 other cases that we had filed in the D.C. Circuit that were put in abeyance pending final determination on the endangerment finding. And those were the cases that actually came up for oral argument only last Friday. the challenge to the greenhouse gas emissions for the truck rule and the challenge to those emissions for the car rule. When those cases were revived, we completed the briefing, and of course, oral argument was held last Friday, as I've indicated. Interestingly, although there are a number of substantive issues, which I want to address very quickly, the court really focused on the standing issues and on one of the three standing requirements. But before I get into standing, I just want to discuss briefly what our written briefs had argued and what the court really, during oral argument, probably asked maybe 20% of their questions on. First is, what is the standard of review applicable here? Is it the Administrative Procedure Act standard of arbitrary, capricious, abuse of discretion not in accordance with law, you know, the straight-up fallback standard of review, or is it the more stringent standard of review set forth in the Clean Air Act for procedural violations of that act? Now, we argued that it was inappropriate to apply the stringent Clean Air Act standard, and that's because neither case was a case involving any allegation that EPA violated the Clean Air Act. The only allegation was that it violated the separate and distinct Science Advisory Board statute. So we felt strongly that the APA standard should apply. We received zero questions on that issue in oral argument. Next, the submittal requirements was a triggered here. For those of you who are familiar with the SAB statute, you know that submittal to SAB is required when EPA provides a proposed rule to any other federal agency for formal review and comment. And we argued here that because these proposed rules were submitted to the Office of Management and Budget under Executive Order 12866 because they had a substantial impact on the national economy, that the OMB review process under that executive order is so elaborate and detailed that it's difficult, frankly, to imagine any more formal review that could occur in connection with regulatory proposals. What the government argued in its brief was that the term formal review is limited to reviews mandated by other statutes, and they argued that a mere OMB review under an executive order does not constitute formal review. Our position was, well, that can't be right because the government wants to amend the SAB statute by adding the term statutory formal review before the term formal review, and that's just not in the statute, and the government can't rewrite the statute. On that issue, too, a very significant issue in the case, we received very little question from the government. We argued, incidentally, that the government's interpretation of the term formal review in the SAB statute is entitled to no deference, not under Chevron and not under Mead, because here they're simply the government is not defining a term in the Clean Air Act, which it administers. It's trying to define a term in an act with which it must comply. And as such, no deference is required. This is not filling the gaps through rulemaking. This is a mandatory requirement that SAB review be obtained. Other substantive issues. The government argued that it was sufficient to publish these rules in the Federal Register and on the Internet, and there was no requirement to actually submit them to the SAB for a review. And, and of course, that goes directly contrary to a 1981 case of the D.C. Circuit in American Petroleum Industries, which held unequivocally that mere publication in the Federal Register was not sufficient, that submittal to the SAB was mandatory, and by extension, mere publication on the Internet should not be deemed sufficient. So that basically was our argument with regard to the Administrative Procedure Act standard of review. But then we went further and said that even if the Clean Air Act substantial likelihood test applied here, even then we met the requirements of that test. And we used as a springboard for the argument the 1982 D.C. Circuit case in Kennecott v. EPA. And as some of you may remember, in that case, EPA's failure to include documents in the administrative record during the public comment period was deemed by the court to raise uncertainty as to what the comments would have been and what EPA's responses to those comments would have been. And that raised, in turn, a substantial likelihood that the rule would have been significantly changed had the documents been included in the administrative record. And what we argued is that the analogy is clear to our case, that EPA's failure to submit the proposed rule to the rules to the SAB for peer review raised uncertainty as to what the SAB's comments would have been, what EPA's responses to those comments would have been, and that in turn raises a substantial likelihood that the rule would have been changed had SAB review been sought. Now, two specific items undergird that reliance on Kennecott. First is the legislative history of the SAB submittal requirement. You recall that I had mentioned in the beginning that the purpose of the requirement was to deal with criticism that EPA's underlying data and scientific review was insufficient to support its regulatory proposals. And so Congress established what it hoped would be a blue ribbon panel of experts to lend credibility to regulatory proposals by providing whatever comments this panel of experts deemed appropriate to EPA before EPA finalized the rules. And so, consequently, we argued that the substantial likelihood that the rules would be significantly changed as a result of SAB review is actually built into the fabric of the SAB review statute. And then the other point undergirding the argument is that we submitted a declaration of a 30-year veteran of the Science Advisory Board, Roger McClellan, who also happened to be for a decade chairman of the board's Clean Air Advisory Panel. And McClellan's declaration basically stated outright that in his opinion, as a veteran of the SAB, there was a substantial likelihood that each of these rules, the truck rule and the car rule, would have been significantly significantly changed as had SAB been given the opportunity to look at them. On all of those issues, with regard to the substantial likelihood test, I would say that among the two cases during oral argument, that maybe there was a total of 5 minutes of questioning by the panel, and that includes my time at the podium and the government's time at the podium. So what did the court actually focus on? It focused on standing. And, of course, as everybody knows, there are three requirements for standing: injury in fact, causation, and redressability. With regard to injury in fact and causation, I think that we may have convinced the court. We have declarations from our clients that basically say they cannot afford the increased costs of the new trucks and cars mandated by the rules, and as a result, they're either going to go out of business or decrease the number of vehicles in their fleets, and in either event, that will mean layoffs of employees directly attributable to the rules. We did go back and forth with the panel on that for several minutes, but I think that they may have been swayed by our arguments, and especially, I mean, I read from the podium the relevant language in the declarations, which the court actually seemed quite interested in listening to. But the key issue that the court really focused on was the issue of redressability. And I want to spend a couple of minutes on that, because that really was the bulk of the time during the oral argument. And the issue is very similar in both the truck rule and the car rule. What pretty much all of the justices ask is, well, even if we grant you the relief that you requested, doesn't California have a similar set of standards? And without the federal standards, your clients would have to comply with the California standards. And so consequently, their injuries will not be taken away by any relief that we could grant. And our response to that argument was this. In 1977, the Supreme Court decided the case of Arlington Heights v. Metro Housing Development Corporation. And there, the court held that petitioner's injuries are redressable when a favorable decision would likely remove one regulatory cause of the injuries. Not every cause of the injury needs to be removed by a favorable decision, but at least one cause of the injury must be removed in order to meet the redressability requirement. And here, if EPA's greenhouse gas regulations are vacated and remanded for future rulemaking, then at least that cause of the injury would be removed. And it's interesting that California standards have a provision that compliance with the federal standards is deemed to be compliance with the California standards, so that vacator of the federal standards and a requirement to reopen the rulemaking process may result in a rule that is less stringent than the current truck rule or car rule. And so there you have the California standard that says compliance with the federal rule is compliance with the California rule. So even there, there would be some relief as a result. So we went actually back and forth on that issue quite a bit. Judge Edwards, in particular, was concerned about redressability, but I must say the judges Tatel and Ginsburg were as well. And then the other issue on redressability had to do with the fact that this is a joint rulemaking of the EPA for greenhouse gas emissions and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, for fuel economy standards. And the question was raised, well, if we get rid of the greenhouse gas emission standards, doesn't that leave the fuel economy standards in place? And won't your clients have to comply with those standards? And so there is no redressability for that reason. And our argument here was twofold. First of all, we raised again the issue of the 1977 Supreme Court case of Arlington Heights, which incidentally was confirmed in a 1982 Supreme Court case, Larson v. Valente. But in addition, we said this, that the preamble to the proposed truck rule and the proposed car rule basically stated that the fuel economy standards and emission standards were developed to function as one national program governing trucks and cars, new trucks and new cars. And the argument was that if one element of that integrated national program, so you have the fuel economy standards that depend on the greenhouse gas emission standards and vice versa. If one element, one half of that national program is vacated, then the other half cannot stand on its own. And so our argument was, in addition to the Supreme Court precedent, that vacater of the greenhouse gas emission standards will necessarily mean that NHTSA will not be in a position to enforce its fuel economy standards because they depend on the greenhouse gas emission standards. On that issue, too, we went back and forth for quite a while. And I will say this, that, you know, even though the judges didn't want to discuss the substantive issues that we raised in the briefing, they did provide both me and the government counsel with pretty much all the time we wanted to take on the redressability standing issue. And there was, a full ventilation on that issue. So, you know, all in all, it's not good form to predict what the D.C. Circuit or any court will do. But I think I can say safely that we were given a full airing of our, at least on the redressability issue, and if the court sides with us on the redressability issue, well, who knows what they're going to do on the injury in fact, causation, and substantive issues. But, you know, in light of the time that they spent on redressability, I'm feeling hopeful about the substantive issues as well. So that's all I have to say up front, and, you know, I'll be happy to address any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had our first question jump on the line.
Ted, Skip Brown out in California.
Hey, Skip, how are you?
Good. I got in a little bit late. That saying, and perhaps I missed it, but how did you successfully get by the standing rule again?
You know what, Skip? We actually used your declaration and Lee Brown's declaration to show that there was injury in fact caused by the rule. And you'll recall that the declarations basically said that you folks are not in a position to afford the new trucks and new cars mandated by the rule, and that'll mean either that A, you go out of business, or B, you'll limit the amount of trucks and cars in your fleet, and in either event, that will result in layoffs of employees. So that
right.
really met two of the three requirements, and the one that was left was redressability, and you know I spent the bulk of the last 10 minutes talking about that.
Right. Okay. Well, it's all accurate. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Kip.
All right, well, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. One quick programming note, our next scheduled telephone conference call is on January 20th at 1 p.m. on judicial campaign fundraising and the Supreme Court. It's another Courthouse Steps telephone conference call featuring Eric Jaffe and Ed Whalen from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. So we don't have any more questions on the line. Any other thoughts, anything else you covered that or that you may not have covered that comes to mind while we're waiting to see if we have any more questions?
Well, I think
we did have one more question jump on the line.
Okay, sure.
Ted, this is...
Oh, go ahead.
Ted, this is Harry McDougald in Atlanta. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. How are you, Harry?
Good. I was curious to know whether when there was any argument that the attempt to raise the SAB issue in the UARG case or, you know, the underlying petitions had any preclusive effect in your litigation.
No, there was nothing in the briefs to that effect and nothing raised in the oral argument other than just a very quick quip that the government lawyer indicated that this was a backdoor channel to deal with the loss in the endangerment finding. But the judges didn't pick up on that, and that took as much time in oral argument as I just took it answering the question.
Okay. Well, more power to you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's keep going. If you have any questions, press star and then the pound key. So as I was saying, any other thoughts that you've got on anything you didn't cover that you might have gotten to? It's okay if you don't.
just two items. One is an economic issue, and one is an issue of principle. With regard to the economics, EPA acknowledged that these rules, each of these rules independently, will have a significant national economic impact. And so, I mean, that's the reason why they were submitted to the Office of Management and Budget for review. And so here you have both a macro significant economic impact and a micro significant economic impact with regard to our clients. And if the SAB requirement would ever be applied, certainly it should be applied in this context where a failure to comply with a mandatory statutory duty has such important macro and micro economic impact. And then the only other thing is just on the level of principle. Some of the folks, maybe all of the folks on the line, may be attuned to the fact that EPA of late has acted as a law unto itself. And this refusal to comply with the Science Advisory Board requirement, I think is a good example of EPA viewing itself as above the law. And it would be great if a message were sent to EPA that it's not above the law, that it's got to comply with legal requirements just like the rest of us have to. And that's it for me.
Well, it looks like we did have one more question jump on the line.
Sure.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Ken Hemington in Washington, D.C. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Question for you. There's this case that I've been tracking a little bit called Murray Energy, which is under the Clean Air Act and non-discretionary duties that EPA has to investigate possible job losses, which I think it has parallel provisions across environmental statutes. I'm wondering whether you have any comments on that, whether you've seen it, that case, which is pending, I think, out in West Virginia, before Judge Preston Bailey. And if you have any other thoughts.
Is that a district court?
U.S. District Court, yes.
No, I haven't been following that. Do you have the name of the case?
If you search for Murray Energy, you could pull it up. And it's just like one of these many embedded statutory duties that's in the environmental statutes, but I think this is probably just a flat-out coal case where they're saying you're not investigating or doing any research into job losses on the worker level. But I haven't seen too much within the academic community discussing it, whether it's another possible avenue of EPA not doing its job. I'm not seeing much of anything. I think that the American Chamber had a lead on this for a short while, that they weren't seeing anything in over 30 years really being done by the agency. But this case is somewhat interesting in that they're being called on the carpet for not doing a statutory duty before something like a coal mine, a plant, could be a refinery, could be any number of companies or corporations subject to the EPA's jurisdiction.
Yeah, Ken, you've actually refreshed my recollection by what you just said. I saw an article, I think it was last week, in the Wall Street Journal on this issue and discussing very briefly the case, but I have not seen any academic analysis of it. And, you know, I'm not sure whether the statute with regard to unemployment impacts, whether that's something, it probably is something outside of the Clean Air Act. I don't know anything in the Clean Air Act that discusses it. But if it is a statutory review requirement outside of the Clean Air Act, that would be similar to, you know, the violation of the Science Advisory Board Act statute, which also is not embedded in the Clean Air Act itself.
I just pulled it up. It's pending out in Northern District of West Virginia in a U.S. District Court. And the site which they're going under is 42 U.S.C. Section 7621, which is Section 21A of the Clean Air Act.
Okay, yeah.
So it's just something to follow, which your litigation sounded to me somewhat parallel, as here you have a statutory mandate by Congress, which they haven't addressed or may have addressed on some perfunctory level in the EPA regulations. But whether or not they're actually executing that duty is, I think, what they're being called on the carpet here for.
Interesting. I'd be interested to take a look at that. Thanks for the citation.
That was my one and only question. Thank you for leading the forum today.
Okay, my pleasure, Ken.
All right. Well, let's do a last call for questions. So if you have a question, press star and then the pound key. Oh, all right. We do have one more question.
Hi.
Go ahead.
This is Leo Dombrowski, society member in Chicago. Putting the standing question aside and assuming that the petitioners get by that hurdle, what did the government say in, and I may have missed this, what did the government say in its briefing and at argument regarding the merits? If it's a clear obligation to comply with the SAB statute, what excuse did the government give for not doing that?
Sure, Leo. I addressed that very briefly during the early part of my presentation, but the Science Advisory Board statute basically triggers the SAB submittal requirement when EPA provides a proposed rule to any other federal agency for formal review and comment. And the key word is formal review and comment. So what the government's position was that there had to be a separate statute outside of the Clean Air Act and outside of the Science Advisory Board Act that required EPA to submit proposed rules for formal review and comment to some other federal agency. But our argument was, well, that's not what the statute says. It only requires a submittal for formal review and comment. And here, there was formal review and comment by the Office of Management and Budget under Executive Order 12866, because this rule has a significant impact on the national economy. It's interesting that neither during the briefing nor during the oral argument did the government cite any statute calling for the kind of EPA formal review that it's seeking to read into the Science Advisory Board Act. And, you know, I looked at the issue, and I don't think there is any. And so basically, if you took the government positions position since 1979, there would be no time when the SAB requirement was triggered, because no statute requires formal review in the sense that the government tries to read into it.
So did anyone on the panel say that EPA has been submitting things to the SAB that they've never had to?
No. The closest they got to that is they asked me whether EPA, before the greenhouse gas cases, had been consistently submitting proposed rules to the EPA, and my response was yes, they had been. And EPA, the government lawyer did not come back and challenge that.
All right. Well, we can do one more last call for questions, since we do have some time left. So star and then the pound key if you'd like to get in a question before we conclude the call. All right. Well, seeing as we've exhausted the questions, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our expert today, as well as you, our audience, for joining us. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please join us this coming Tuesday at 1 p.m. for our next scheduled telephone conference call. And a reminder that you can find the podcast of this telephone conference call, as well as all of our previous telephone conference calls, on our website at www.fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.